Okay, so this is the last piece of this whole course, and I wanted to talk about computer-supported cooperative work because it's an area where there is normally an elective in the master's, but because I'm away this year, we couldn't open it this year, and so I still wanted to give you a glimpse of what it is about. These are slides that were originally my slides, that then Nicolas Roussel, who's a former student of mine and has been teaching here and is now at INRIA, but in Lille, in the north of France, I've redone the slides, and so I've borrowed it from him again, and so that's important to give credit. So, in English, what I'm going to talk about is called CSCW, computer-supported cooperative work. So work that is done cooperatively, that is supported by computers. It's also often called also groupware, although groupware tends to describe only the software that is used to do CSCW, and CSCW is the area in general. So in French, they've invented the Frenchism collecticiel, which is logiciel, to work collectively, which I think is actually kind of good. I do use it in France, in French. And then TCAO is the French translation of CSCW. It's an area that is old. In fact, the earliest work in that was the work conducted by Doug Engelbart on NLS Augment that I talked about in the first class with the historical material. So that was in the 60s. There were conferences that were established that dealt, and still exist, that deal exclusively with this topic called CSCW, an ACM conference, ECSCW, which is the European version. There are also other conferences. There's one called GROUP, and there's a number of other conferences that include those topics. And with the advent of social networks, Facebook and all that, this area is sort of completely, has expanded from what it used to do before, which was really targeted towards using computers for collaborative tasks in the work environment. But now with networked games, with social networks, with the internet in general, this area is really developing. And the thing is, you could argue that all of HCI is CSCW. I mean, how many times are you using a computer solely by yourself to do stuff that only you will use again? It's very rare. So even if computers are often used individually, it's most often in the context of collective tasks, right? So there has been many definitions of CSCW, and the reason is that HCI is already a multidisciplinary field that is bridging essentially computer science with psychology. But when you bring the notion of group, then you have sociology, anthropology, ethnography, and other natural sciences that come in. And so it multiplies the number of perspectives that people have on what CSCW is, should be, and is about. So if you look at Bannon and Schmidt, who really come from the sociology side of things, CSCW should be considered as a tentative to understand the nature and characteristics of cooperative work, with the goal to design an appropriate computer technology to support it. So here we see that the emphasis, the accent, is put on understanding the nature of cooperative work, how people work together. And then once we understood this, we can design the appropriate technology. Now, if you look at Ellis, Gibbs, and Ryan, who are coming from computer science, Ellis in particular has done a lot of work in databases before moving into this area. Their definition is computer systems that assist groups of users engaged. I'm sorry, I'm fixing the typos as I go. Engaged in a common task and that provide an interface to a shared environment. You know, there's the word users in there, but the focus is on the technology, right? With sort of the underlying idea that people will adapt to the technology and make it work for them. And then there is yet another approach, again from more the computer science aspect, but which is looking at, well, you know, we have been using computers with multiple users for a long time. Time sharing systems in the 60s were about doing that. But what we've been doing since the 60s was really to try to have multiple users use a single computer, but as if it was their personal computer. So everything was done to isolate users from each other, to make sure they would not know what each other is doing, and so to not work cooperatively. So while most software attempt to hide and protect users from each other, groupware makes users aware that they belong to a group and that they work with each other. So, the scope of CSCW is really very large. What we will find time and again is this distinction between different types of things you do together. So there is cooperation, communication, collaboration. Now, in your heads, these are probably, you know, sort of the same thing, right? Well, if you look at it more carefully, it's not really that. When we communicate, we exchange information. So email is a CSCW tool. It allows people to communicate by sending messages to each other. Cooperation is more tightly integrated than communication. When we cooperate, we work together towards a common goal. So we can do that through communication systems, but cooperation will usually require more specific tools. One word I didn't put in here that I should have put is coordination. Well, coordination is, on the contrary, more loose. We coordinate is, you know, we meet, we say, okay, you're going to do this, you're going to do that, and we meet in a week, and you send me the documents, and we'll see what's next. Cooperation and collaboration are pretty close. In both cases, there's the idea that people have the same goal. There's another category of CSCW systems that are about negotiation. So if you go to your bank to try to get the banker to give you a loan, well, you are trying to work towards the same goal. You want the loan, you want to sell your loan, but you have different objectives. You're trying to get the lowest rate, he's trying to give you the highest rate. So it's the negotiation, it's not a collaboration. So, you know, there's a first issue about what systems exactly does this cover? And we'll see a lot of different things. Then there's a question of how to design the systems, how do we make them work? And in pretty much every case, when you go to implement CSCW system, you deal with distributed systems, systems that need to run on multiple computers that communicate with each other. So in computer terms, you know, it gets tricky immediately. There are a few systems where multiple people interact with the same computer, people have done systems for classrooms, for example, where you plug as many mice as there are students, and they all can, this is for little kids, work on the same computer and draw together on the same computer. But in general, these systems tend to be distributed, so it gets complicated. And then there is the human side of things, which on the one hand is supposed to inform the design of these systems. What are the cooperative tasks that we're trying to help achieve with computers? But then there is the other side, is once we've created the systems, how does it affect the users? One good example is email. Email is destructive. I hate email. I spend hours and hours every day dealing with email. Before email was generalized, you know, you had to write letters and type them and print them and put in the mail and pay to mail them. And it would take 3 days to arrive, and then the person maybe would reply. So because of email, we are involved in so many more tasks at the same time. People come to expect you to react in the minute, not in days. People use their mailbox as a to-do list. This is what I do. I flag the messages that are about something I have to do. The problem is that, and that's why I may not reply to some of your messages, I miss some messages because I don't recognize that it comes from someone I need to pay attention to. And when you have, even without spam and all the noise, I have over 100 messages a day. You know, some just disappear or don't get noticed. And then even the ones that I flag, if they scroll outside of the window too far away, I will never get back to them. I just don't have the time. And so a number of people, and you can talk to, you know, everybody in this lab, and I'm sure a lot of people you know who are in other types of jobs, their life is slave to email. So this has had a big effect on computer use. People have studied email overload, and some people, like Wendy Mackay, you will see when she comes here to teach the beginning of the course on participatory design and evaluation of user interfaces, had done a study of email overload in 1988. So she could see that this was coming. So the effect of these systems on users is a very important aspect of CSCW. So as I said, Engelbart really pretty much invented everything. or maybe he created the problems we're now trying to solve, I don't know. But he created a system where you had file sharing, where you have personal annotations of shared documents, where you have electronic messaging, where you have video conferencing, not just audio conferencing, where you share documents with telepointers so we could both see what parts we're pointing at and things like this. And the reason is because what he was interested in was exactly the topic of CSCW. How can humans and computers work together to solve problems that a single human or a group of human or a single computer or a set of computers cannot solve alone? So when you need multiple humans, typically with multiple expertise, and a lot of computers to support their tasks. So what I'm going to do, because this is just an introductory class, is give you a list of systems and examples of CSCW systems. So the first, because it's the oldest and the most used, is email. So I will not describe email itself. You all know how it works. But I will describe a system built in the 80s that was designed to help people deal with email already, and email overload in particular. And it's called the Information Lens. And the idea here is that a message is what Tom Malone calls a semi-structured object. There is a part, the text, which is pure text. It's in French and English and whatever language. And you don't try to go in and see what's in there. But there's a part that is structured, the headers. It says who sent it, to whom, who was copied, it has the date. And so what they did in information lens, they allowed users to add more what we call today metadata to a message. So it could have something like topic, which is not exactly the same thing as subject. Subject is precise, topic is more like what you would use to tag messages today. And the idea was to augment these messages with those, you can call them tags if you want, so that people could write rules that would help them sort email, do automatic replies, and things like this. So you could say, well, you know, when I receive a message and the topic is lens, then I want to put it into that folder, for example. Which is much better than saying, you know, there is lens in the subject line. Because lens is a common word, and, you know, maybe you're ordering contact lenses on the web, and it will mistake things. So by using this extra information, you can do rules that are better, more targeted. Now, Wendy Mackay has worked with Tom Malone in this system and could tell you a lot more about it. One of the things is that once you have the rules, you can, the system can have some knowledge of what people are, quote, interested in. If you write a rule about something to archive those messages or to do something other than delete them, you know that you are interested in this. So they started creating something where you could send mail to anyone. And you see here the CC is anyone. And anyone did not mean anyone. It meant all of those for which there is a rule that filters that message. And it looked like a clever invention, right? If you're interested in the lens topic, well, you're going to filter those messages. So I don't have to me decide who's interested. I'll let the system figure this out based on people who have expressed interest. The problem, of course, is that everybody started to send email to anyone. And so, in the end, it was not working as well as expected. But there is this problem in email is how, where is the control on who received the information? Right now, and still now, the control is on the sender. Things like mailing lists, distribution lists, where you can subscribe, transfer some controls into the receiver. But it's still something that is not well solved in today's system. So in the 80s, Xerox PARC was once again at the forefront of research in those areas. And they created an environment that is not unlike what Engelbart had done 20 years ago. And it was called the CoLab, Collaborative Laboratory. And they developed software that was used in rooms like this one. So targeting small meetings in rooms that were specially equipped with large screens, you know, 87, it was not that common to have these types of projectors here and the large display screen and things like this. And so they looked at the type of things that people do in those meetings, and they created a set of tools to support those tasks. So one of the things people do is they do hand drawing, they do diagrams. You know, you chat, you discuss, and then someone stands up and goes to the board and say, well, what if you organize things like this? So they created a hand drawing tool that could be used from your workstation or at the display. In fact, in the context of that project, I'm not sure now if it's in that project or shortly after, but they were really one of the first ones to have large boards where you could display information but also capture input, like large touch screen. The other thing that people do in meetings is organize ideas, create outlines. So Cognodar was a system like a text editor, but really an outliner. And again, was shared. Everybody could add and remove things. And then there was the argumentation spreadsheet, Argnodar. And the idea here is that what happens in meetings, people make decisions. And the problem oftentimes is that after the meeting, you don't remember how we got to that decision. And so what Argnodar was a system where people could record and keep track of the arguments that are made and have a trace of why a particular decision was reached. So it's something that was, well, sometimes useful during the meeting, because in long, complex meetings with lots of people, well, here it's small groups, but even with small groups, sometimes you you loop, right? You get back to the same arguments again and again. So by having them there on the screen, you say, okay, well, we've already talked about this, so it was useful during the meetings, but also after the meetings when you were revisiting a decision and trying to figure out why it happened. In the context of this work, they invented these acronyms of WYSIWYS. What you see is what I see. So remember the WYSIWYG, what you see is what you get, which was the idea that what you see on the screen is what you get on the printer, on paper. So here, WYSIWYS is what you see is what I see, is this notion that we can share screen. But of course, you don't want to share all of your screen. So the real concept here is WYSIWYS. What you see is almost what I see. So there are things that we decide to share and things that we keep private. So this is what they call strict view congruence versus relaxed view congruence. So view congruence is that we share the same document, but when it's strict view, we also share the view on this document. So if I scroll, you scroll. If you scroll, I scroll. And sometimes this is what you want, because, you know, if you review a document line by line, okay, it's fine. More often, you want the relaxed view congruence, that we share the same document, but I'm looking at this while you're looking at that. And ideally, of course, you want a tool that would by default be the bottom thing here, relaxed, but where you could sort of make it strict if for a period of time you want to work really strictly together. I'm going to skip cooperative buildings, get back to it in a second, because in sort of a historical order, I need to talk about shared editing first. So shared editing, in fact, you know what? I'm going to swap the order in the slides. So. So we had a perfect example here of the system doing something that didn't ask it to do, which means to do a backup. Precisely when I was going to do something that I have now lost, and I'm spending three times as much time to figure out how to fix it. Sorry about that. Well, maybe there was a reason why it was there after all. I'm sorry. Okay, so let's talk about cooperative buildings then, since it seems to belong here in the flow. Even though this was done a lot later, this is a work by Norbert Streitz in Germany. But the idea here is that, as we saw in the collab, you need to design furniture and environment to work well for this type of work. And the thing is, early on, it was really centered about cooperative work and centered about the meeting room and the, you know, adding to the meeting room all these computers, this large screen, the software, and all these things. So the work on cooperative building, although I don't really like the term, is, was to support other forms of collaboration. You know, if I'm in my office and someone comes in and we start discussing, you know, some great idea about, I don't know, beating Fitts' law, you know, we're going to go on the board and start drawing things and take notes and look at documents online and things like this. So a lot of these collaborative tasks happen informally. Meetings are formal. There are many other things that are informal. So here they had, you know, the idea of creating large interactive walls where people could, you know, come in without having being in the meeting, but just getting there to discuss ideas. Do it on a table, around the table as well, as opposed to in front of the wall. Wall and table, you know, it's different kind of things that you would do in those settings. There's more space on the wall, but you have to stand, so it's tiring. On the table, you have a problem of organizing content for several people in different directions, but, you know, you can sit down and relax and take the time it takes. They even had these chairs that had a laptop in them, so you could sit in a chair, and if you needed to get access to online documents, you would use that laptop, and you could also share the content of the laptop with the other furniture. So this is an aspect that shows that maybe even more than traditional interfaces, these tools for CSW have to take into account the environment and the way people communicate. So there's a vast category of tools that deal with shared editing. Now, here we are in a task that is often done at a distance. The things we saw before, meetings of various sorts, are usually done when people are in the same room. We'll talk in a moment about what happens when people are not in the same space. But these were really designed for what we call co-located, same space, collaboration. A lot of the tools that were done for shared editing were more designed for remote collaboration. So we're writing a paper together, but you are in your office or in mine, and maybe it's the same building, maybe it's in two different countries. What we still want to do is to edit the same document in real time. And the way it's done today is that we don't have these shared editors. There are very few of them. And so what we do is we write things and we send the document, and the other one is waiting to make his changes, or is to merge his changes with my changes. And sometimes some system can help automate that, but it's really painful. It's really painful. And I do not understand why, you know, it's been 20, 30 years that people have worked on this issue. We know how to solve the technical issues. But still, the tools that the majority of people use don't support shared editing. So some tools were designed to be asynchronous with this notion that you do changes independently and then you try to merge them. So prep here was one of them. And that was more, not so much for maybe people editing really the document together, but having the content and comments put in the document, and then you want to get the comments back and things like this. So this was the prep editor as an example. So this is an example of an asynchronous editor, but most of the work has concentrated on synchronous editing, also called real-time. So the first one was Grove, and Grove supported, so Grove means Group Outline Viewing Editor. It supported shared editing at the character level. So you are on your computer, on mine, I type key on the keyboard, it inserts that letter, and you see that letter immediately. You could have what was called private, shared, and public views. So you could edit privately and then share it, or share it immediately. And then there were these features to provide what we call in CSCW, and particularly shared editing, the notion of awareness. Being aware, knowing what the other is doing. So it's one thing that when you type text, it's showing up in on my screen, but I may, since I'm concentrating on what I am doing, I may not see it. So these little clouds would show up around the text that had been edited recently by another user. So by browsing the document, I could find these clouds which show where someone is active. The other thing is that changes would first appear blue and then turn black progressively. So by going through the document, I can see where things have been changed recently. And so these kind of features here are really important. So shared editing is not just that you have to synchronize the two views or the two documents, but it's also you want to provide tools so the others know what I'm doing and so that I know what the others are doing. And you want to do it in such a way that it's not distracting, that it's not affecting, well, it is affecting my work, but I should be able to ignore it if I'm not interested in knowing about it. And so so now I skip prep and I go directly to SASE. So in SASE, we have shared editing with a number of features. For example, you notice on the right, there are two scroll bars. So the one on the very right is green, and it's the regular scroll bar. The one next to it has two thumbs, a blue one at the top, a red one at the bottom. And these are the. This shows the position of the other two users of this document. So the blue user is at the top, and so we're seeing pretty much the same thing. And the red one is at the bottom. And if you look at the bottom part of the right image here, what you see is what's called a radar view, a view of the complete document. And it shows you where the other users are in blue and in red. And this view, I can decide to open it and see it, or I can decide to close it, and I'm not interested, like that was done on the left. Okay? Now, the last tool in this family is a tool that a student of mine, Alain Carcenti, developed. It was called Group Design. And the idea there was to go from text editing, which had been at the time really the focus of most of the work, to shared drawings, like when you create a diagram. And it creates some different issues. First of all, these types of document are 2D documents, so you need to scroll in two directions. But more importantly, in text, when you do editing, you insert text or you remove text, but the text is essentially linear. I mean, it's then wrapped into a 2D document, but the editing is done in this linear structure. Here, people can do really radical changes with just a few commands. So one of the things is that we wanted to give people good awareness of what the others were doing. So we came up with this notion of a semantic echo of what the others are doing. So imagine I am resizing the rectangle here under a local node. So if I am the person doing the interaction, I want the feedback. I need the feedback to resize. So locally, what I see is I click the handle, for example, and I start resizing, and I see the rectangle change size. And at the end of the interaction, I release the button, and that's it. Now, the other nodes, they're probably not interested in all the detail of this interaction. So what we decided is that all they needed to know is that someone was interacting with that object to avoid conflicting. So that's what the icon on the right shows. Someone is resizing this. But that's it. Just the icon shows up. Meanwhile, I can spend half an hour, you know, deciding on the right size. When I'm done, on the right side, for the remote sites, the node will animate, will grow. And the animation is important because they don't know what I'm doing. So the animation will, and we know that the eye is more sensitive to movement in the periphery, so they will notice that something is happening. So this is the kind of thing that the clouds in Grove were trying to achieve, to tell you where things is happening. Here we're giving more precise information. So we've looked at very tightly coupled tasks when you do shared editing at the character level or the level of really elementary actions. There's a whole other line of research that is about workflow systems. So in workflow systems, the goal here is to organize, it's a coordination system. Coordination system. People need to coordinate their actions. And what you find in many companies is that the coordination occurs around the document. So the classic case is some customer orders something from your company. So you have an order coming in, and it has to go through inventory to see if you have it in stock, and then to shipping, where you have to ship the object, and then to invoicing, where you want to be paid for it, and so you have to invoice the... And at any time in the process, things can go wrong. Maybe we are out of stock, so we need to go back to the customer and tell it, do you want to wait, or do you want your money back, and all these things. So a number of systems have been built that are centered around the document. And metadata, additional information, is added to the document as it goes through the system. So, for example, we decide that we need to write this report, we have a meeting or something, and we decide that, you know, Alex will do the first version, has to be done by April 15, and then Bob will have to proofread it by April 22nd, and then Charlie has to approve it a week later, and then finally Dan, who's probably the big boss, has to have it by May 4th. And so the idea is that by adding this information to the document can know its way in the organization. It can also know that, you know, if it hasn't been edited or proofread or sent or something by a given date, it should send a reminder. So the document becomes active. So one of the most famous systems in that area was created by Terry Vinograd and Fernando Flores in the late 80s, and was called the Coordinator. Now, what they were doing in the Coordinator is they were not, in fact, using documents themselves. They were using the email system. And they were using a theory called the Speech Act theory that says that when you look at how people interact with each other, talk to each other, communicate with each other, especially in the business environment, there's a number of speech acts that you can extract from their conversations. Things like request. You'll have to write the first version of the document by next week. A promise, say, okay, I'll do it. Sometimes you have negotiation. So you have to write this by next week. And you can say, I'm sorry, but you know, I have too much work, I'm traveling, so it will have to be 10 days. So you make a counter to my request, to which I may reply by, well, okay, let's do it by the weekend. So it's this negotiation. Maybe at some point you can cancel, say, well, no way, I'm sorry, not going to do it. Or you accept. So you have this graph here that shows all the transitions between these different states for this negotiation and all the speech acts that drive these changes. And so what the coordinator was doing is through emails, people were flagging their emails as this is a request, this is a promise, this is etc. And so the system could keep track of where you were. And so if you've promised that you'll write the document by next Sunday, and I haven't seen anything by Saturday, I will send you an email reminder. This is an interesting system because it created a lot of criticism, especially the people who were coming from a sociology background found it was unacceptable that people would be slaves to a system like this. And if you look in the literature, there was, I think, a full special issue of a famous journal that was put out with people, you know, criticizing the coordinator, and then Winograd and Flores defending it. And then, so they were having a whole series of speech acts about the coordinator itself. And today, the thing is, these workflow systems are everywhere in companies. Companies like SAP, you probably heard of SAP, they sell this, you know, enterprise management system, whatever they call them. Essentially, there are huge workflows where all the activities in the company are turned into computerized processes, and you're supposed to, you know, follow what the computer tells you to do. And it's, I mean, I personally find this quite bad because it's not done in a way that takes into account the flexibility of human work. There was an example at Park where they were working on these things as well, and it was a system where, you know, Park was selling, or Xerox rather, was selling photocopiers. And someone was ordering a photocopier. And so sends in the order, and the person is at the computer typing the order and cannot confirm the order and before it knows where to deliver, where to ship the photocopier. So she asked the person, where should I ship it? And the answer is, it depends when you're shipping it. And the person at Xerox says, well, I don't know how long it's going to take. So where should I deliver it? And the person says, I don't know. It depends when you're shipping it. And it turns out that the person was on a ship and needed a photocopier on a ship. And of course, the ship is moving, right? It's not going to stay waiting for the photocopier to arrive. And the system had not taken this into account, and they were stuck. And so, you know, well, they had to make do with the system. They put a fake address, and they agreed that he would call, or she would call him when she knew the delivery date, and they would update the order and things like this. But that's a typical example of things that happen when you turn this type of very fluid human processes into computer processes. They become rigid. And how many times, I don't know about you, I've been around longer, so maybe I've run into these things more often, but you know, you go to a place and you try to do something and they tell you, oh no, the computer can do that. And you know, maybe sometimes it's used as an excuse, but oftentimes it's really the case that computers make things more rigid. So it's something to keep in mind when you create these types of system, is to account for all the flexibility of human, and especially when you talk about human communication. You know, if depending on who makes me a promise that he will do this by that date, I know if I can count on it, or if I have to add 3 days, or if I should not count on it. These are not things you can put in the system. People in the real world, they like to have what they call plausible deniability. Plausible deniability. So deniability, when you deny something, is, I'll tell you, why didn't you see my email? And you say, no, I didn't see your email. Well, did you really not see the email, or are you pretending you didn't see the email? But the thing is convenient because we know that email can get lost, or it can go into the spam. So it gives you a plausible way to say, well, no, I didn't see him, sorry. In fact, you've seen the email and you know you're late, but you want to admit it. But if the person knew that you're lying, you know, it would make everything awkward, or maybe you would get fired. So having all this sort of ability to adjust, and this is really all situated action, as we talked before. People adapt to the context and decide how to do things. And that happens all the time. And it's less the case when you have a single user interacting with the computer, but as soon as you have groups of people, you have all these human relationships that you cannot sort of turn into computer systems in this very strict way here. And speaking of communication systems, a lot of work has been done to see how people could collaborate at a distance with the same type of comfort and fluidity that you have when you are face to face. When you are face to face, a lot of things are going on. You can tell from the social distance that people have, how well they know each other, or where they are in the organization. You can, looking at the eye gaze, where people are looking, also if they're engaged or not engaged, or this or that. So there's a lot going on when two people are discussing face to face. If you put this at a distance, it becomes very difficult to reproduce all these things. So this is, on the top left, the hole in space, is an installation that was done in 1980 between New York and Los Angeles. And they took two stores on, you know, very well-known streets. I don't quite remember if it was Broadway. But anyway, so, and in those streets, they put a large screen with a projected image of what was happening at the other place. So they had a camera towards the street, and so the image of Los Angeles was projected in New York, and the image taken in New York was projected in Los Angeles. And there were also microphones and loudspeakers, so you could have also an audio link. And they didn't explain what it was, what it did, they just put it there. That was done by two artists, Rabinovich and I can't remember. And spontaneously, within minutes, people realized that this was an interactive installation. That they came in front of this, that the people they could see would also hear them. And of course, the first thing is, you ask, where are you? And they say, New York, Los Angeles. And how is this working? What is that? And this was installed for a few days. And almost immediately, people started to make appointments by phone, say, OK, let's go. And you know, there was no Skype and no video communication at the time. So let's go say hi in front of the camera. And that shows you the power of this audio-visual communication that we have every time we are together in the same space. And so shortly after that, in the early 80s, and again, it started at Xerox PARC. There was a lot of work done at Belcor as well, which was a telephone company. They created what it was called a media space. So what Xerox did, they took a research group and they split it in two. They left one half in California. They sent the other half to Oregon, Portland. Less sun, I must say. Less nice place. Well, the trees are beautiful, but... and they installed this kind of link that I was just talking about, audio-video link that was always on, and they observed how people were able or not able to work at the distance in the same way that they were used to work together. And then a number of these media spaces were installed in various places, and people started to understand what it took to work at a distance. And then people started to combine communication at a distance with sharing documents. So Teamwork Station, and then VideoDraw, and then ClearBoard, all three were prototypes where people could see each other, talk to each other, while they were editing a shared document. And ClearBoard, to the right, was the most advanced because you had this surface where you could draw, and the image of the person you were talking to was projected from behind, and the camera was also taking your image from behind, so it could track your eye gaze. You could look at the other in the eye, literally, which you cannot do with other systems. In this computer, for example, the camera is right above the screen here. But if I'm, and you've probably experienced that, if I'm Skyping with someone, to look the other person in the eye, I have to look at the camera, and if I look at the camera, I don't see her image. And so we can't really have the eye contact that we use all the time in real life. So ClearBoard was one of the first systems. There was another one before based on half-silvered mirrors and other technology that created the same effect. And it makes a big difference. It makes a big difference. Especially when you work with people you don't know, because a lot of the establishment of trust goes with looking other people in the eye. So in the mid-90s, a lot of these systems were deployed in various laboratories. I spent a few months at the University of Toronto, where they had a system where every office had a TV with a camera, microphone, loudspeaker, and could connect to every other office. And just inside, it's weird because, you know, you can walk down the hall and see your colleagues. But office to office, even inside the same lab, turned out to be very useful. In fact, it's funny because when I came back from this sabbatical here in France, I was alone in my office. And I was feeling alone. So a lot of these things were used. So, you know, you have this always open link with another colleague that, you know, I mean, that you like. And so you're not using it to speak all the time and work all the time together, but it's like sharing an office. Except that if someone else is coming into your office and you are to chat, you can turn off the microphone. So it's really the advantages of sharing an office without the disadvantages. And so one of the things I did with Nicolas Roussel, who did all these slides and did his thesis on the topic, was to create the first media space in France at the time, between a few offices, and did some work on the going from local media spaces, because at the time, the things they did at Xerox between Portland and California was long-distance link, was costing a fortune. Then what they had in Toronto and what we did here were literally to have analog cable, TV cable really, go from one monitor to all the monitors to a central switch. It was really a complex system because we didn't have real-time digital video at the time. And so what Nicolas Roussel studied is the early attempts of doing media spaces over long distances, which was helped by the fact by that his girlfriend was in a different country, and so it was a good motivation to to work on these systems. So I'm going to skip. Well, Video Place is an interesting piece of work. I don't know if you are familiar with the work of Myron Kruger, but is one of the people very early on in the 70s was doing this amazing systems that had a camera, and you could see the outline of yourself on the screen. So this green shape or this red shape. And he created all sorts of programs that allowed people to play in this environment. So the red figure on the right, that's Critter. So this little green thing above his hand is a little like a bug, a little animal. And you could take it in your hand and throw it, and it would fall down, and then it would climb along your shape. It was very... At the time, I think I saw that in 85, 86. It was quite fascinating. And so he did a version of this called Video Place, where you had two people in two different spaces, and they could interact with each other in various ways that he had programmed into the system. So one person was really big and the other very small, and so you could play at crushing the other person like this. The thing that was fascinating is that even though it was just these shapes, people very spontaneously were communicating through movement. So I think it's an interesting piece of work to show how people use every medium you put in their hands to communicate. And in fact, this brings me back to email. Because you know, you don't know, I'm sure. You know how email got invented? So very early on, you had only very few computers. And they tend to be specialized. And so you had computing centers in various places, mostly in the United States. And each computer had one or more operators. And you would give them a job that they were in charge of getting the computer to execute. But sometimes someone else had a better computer to do the job than you had. So they had a system very early on to send files to each other's computer. And what they would have to do is to get on the phone, because they would be able to send the file, but they would have to discuss with the other on the phone what to do. So then they tweaked the system so that you could attach a little message to the file saying, oh, please, Rob, can you do this for me? And then, of course, they started to use it to just talk to each other. And so because the messages had to be attached to a file, they were shipping, you know, empty files or, I don't know, fake files, just so they could exchange messages. Now, the funny thing today is that the things is completely reversed, because now we use messages to attach documents, when it used to be that you send files to attach messages. But there's another story also about the Minitel in France. So for those of you who've never heard about the Minitel, the French government in the late 70s, early 80s, created a system where they wanted to replace the white pages, the phone book. And they created a terminal, and they told you, if you agree to use the terminal, you will have free access to the phone book for all of France. It used to be you only had the phone book for your local area, right? You have the phone book online for all of France, and you also have access to other services in there, but we won't give you the paper one. And so that was called a Minitel. The equipment was free, and for the access to the phone book, it was free, and for the other services, you would have to pay the cost of a phone call. And that was called the Minitel. And the services you had were mostly information services about the schedule for the trains or planes or things like this. And the French telecom, before they deployed that widely, they did an experiment near Paris in Vélizy, where they installed this terminal in, I think, like 700 households. People who were not, you know, into computers in any kind of way, and in 77 anyway, there were not many personal computers out. And so they were trying to see how people would use this. And one thing they had done is there was a way for them to see what people were doing, so they could see on their screen what the user had in front of him. And they had a way to send a message to the bottom line. This was a very small terminal, 24 lines of 40 characters. But they had the ability to send a message at the bottom, which to the user would look like it came from the computer. And it was a help message. When the engineers monitoring what was happening realized that someone was stuck, they would type a message saying, well, why don't you try to do this? And to people, it was like, oh, that's a helpful system. But the funniest thing is some people who were more into technology than others realized that they could hack into this messaging system, and they started using it to talk to each other. And very quickly, people were doing things that the engineers in the telecom company were like, you know, no, you shouldn't. That's not the point of this. So they were quite angry. But, you know, it's a technology that was really adapted by the users to use it for communicating to each other, because they found that a lot more interesting than just, you know, looking at the schedule for the trains or whatever system was available. And in fact, the reason the Minitel was a very big success is through all the messaging systems that came out. And you're probably too young now to know, but you know, in the 70s, 80s, and up till the mid-90s, even when the internet was starting to, and the web, I should say, rather than the internet, was starting to be more widespread, people were using the Minitel. And a lot of these were messaging system bulletin boards where people would exchange email or send mails to share lists. Now, a lot of this had to do with, you know, what was called pink messaging. But it was really the major source of income from the telecom, more than the services that the system was originally designed for. And so my point with all this is that people communicate. And the reason for Facebook and the explosion of Facebook is exactly the same thing. And the way it was created was not for people to communicate. If you've seen the movie about Facebook, you know, it was for a different purpose. So every time you create a technology, people will adapt it to communicate. Even the phone was not created for person-to-person communication. One of the uses, early uses of the phone was for someone in a big store, the chief of staff, so he would be able to address all his employees at once. So it was a broadcast system. And then it was deployed, and it was also designed to be used to pick up the phone, dial a number, and you would get information. So, and I don't know the exact story for this one, but it started to be used for person to person. And to me, it's fascinating how telephone systems, systems like Skype, all these things are really, I mean, I feel compared to the power we have in the computers and the networks, I think, you know, this is still 20 years behind what it should be. The fact that they cannot easily share a document, establish a video connection with someone, doesn't make sense to me. One particular example set of systems that were done for this distant communication were CVEs, collaborative virtual environments. And here the idea is that people would be at a distance, but the goal was to make them feel that they were really sharing a space. So, you know, this is Second Life 30 years ago. So the avatars are a little bit blocky, but it's exactly the idea that you're presented by an avatar and you can communicate with people who are nearby, and there are objects in the environment, and you can put objects and share things and things like this. Social networks were invented before Facebook. I hope it doesn't come as a surprise. But people have been using shared messaging systems for a long time. There was an early system in the 80s called Zephyr, for example. So this one is Babel. It was done at IBM. And here what it does is that, so it's like a chat window where everybody can post messages, and there are various chat groups. What it added is visualization of the history of who has talked when, so you can see who is engaged in the conversation. And the what they call the chat circle in the middle, this round thing with the little colored dots in the middle, each dot represents one of the people on the conversation, so you see their names on the left. And the more active they are, the closer they are to the center. So this gives you an awareness of who is involved in a conversation and who is not involved, or maybe because they are not interested or they're away. And so a number of these systems were deployed in the 90s. So social computing and social networking has been around for a long time. Still a mystery to me how something like Facebook can be so dominant, but that's another story. So this is another example called chat circles with more fancy visualizations, but essentially same rough idea. Here's another example that is not really social networking, but it's a system that is designed for supporting tutoring. So we're moving now in the area of tutoring and distance learning, e-learning. So here someone is using a shell and is having trouble, and so the other person at the distance, or there are two in fact of them, Bo and John, can annotate things, circle things on the screen, do small diagrams, and from a distance help a person who's having trouble with this particular application. And that's again something that, in my view, should be part of every single application in the world. It should be, you know, as basic as saving or doing undo. The notion of annotation. Whether it's done in this context of someone at a distance annotating, which you get all the time. You know, I write a document, I send it to you, you want to annotate it and send it back. But I want to annotate things for myself as well. So why isn't annotation part of every application? Something missing here. Another example of a system that helps people share information is the notification collage. It's not unlike the Facebook wall, but that was done 10 years ago. So people can post on this shared wall notes, photos, web links, and things like this. So it's funny because, you know, I was doing this 3 years ago, and it was like, wow. And then within 3 years, everybody's on Facebook. It's like, eh. So I'm not sure what else to say. The only point is, as many innovations, the original invention has been done a long time ago. So. Now, another interesting area is network games, because these have been around for a long time. And I've already said that for interaction, but games are really an area where you see the future before it gets there. The reason is because games are not constrained by the same things as regular applications. They're not constrained to work together with a bunch of other applications in the environment. They took over the whole screen and the whole world. And the other thing is, really, the value of a game is in the gameplay, which includes interaction, which includes the ability to share your game with others, and these types of features. So it's interesting that another big part of games is the quality of graphics rendering. And the reason we have GPUs and this amazing graphical power today in computers is because of games. Otherwise, it would have never happened. And so it's interesting that games demonstrate that things like the quality of interaction and the ability to have collaborative or collective games really adds to the game experience, and that these lessons are not translated to regular applications. So, I don't know. You know what game is that? You probably know better than I do. Sorry? Okay. So it's not World of Warcraft. I guess. No. Yeah, you're right. But there's a lot of these, as you know, and as my kids know. I find it fascinating now that you have these games. My older son plays a bunch of games, but soccer games or skateboard games where you can actually create video clips of your best trick, and then you put that online on YouTube. Which is another form of building up communities. So, this was meant to give you an overview of what happening in that space, and a lot of things are happening. And of course, as researchers, we always try to look at, what are the common points, where are the differences between all these things, and can we build taxonomies and frameworks and design spaces around this to better understand what's going on and make systems more powerful and useful. So a number of people have made classifications of these various systems. So a classic one is the time, distance, and size matrix. So are people in the same location or are they far away? That's the distance. Is interaction occurring in real time or asynchronously? So email is asynchronous, chat is synchronous. And what is the size of the group? Is it designed for small groups, middle-sized groups, two people, pairs, or very large groups? There are other classifications, so maybe a better way to look at this is various dimensions to look at these systems. Another one is it focused on exchanging, like email, or is it focused on sharing? And it becomes a little bit blurry because a lot of people share things by communicating them, by exchanging them. But if I have a Word file, I send you the Word file, we're not sharing it. I give you a version, I have another version, and things will diverge and things like this. So sharing is really when we are, where the system makes us believe at least that we're editing the same document. Exchanging is through sending things back and forth. Another way to look at these things is how the social protocols are taken into account. Is the system really constraining users to behave according to a norm, like in the workflow systems I showed, or is it more open and supporting open participation and counting on people themselves to organize the social protocols? You know, when you have two or three or four people writing on a whiteboard, they are not bumping into each other, they are not riding over each other unless they do it explicitly. So we are very good at managing space and time in interaction. If you do this at a distance and you don't provide the right cues, the right help, the right awareness, people are going to have a hard time coordinating. So that's something to take into account if you design these kind of things. And well, we saw sharing versus exchanging. Here we have production versus communication, which is, are we talking about, well, it's a different dimension, really. So production versus communication is, are we talking about something, or are we trying to create something together? Of course, the two go hand in hand oftentimes, but interestingly, the tools usually support one or the other. So one way that I find useful to look at things is through these three dimensions of production, coordination, communication. And so in many tasks that are performed collaboratively, you will find these three aspects. In some cases, one, maybe two, is not present. In most cases, they have different emphasis. So the bubbles are not the same size for every task. So the production space is a space where you share, well, you create artifacts, documents, things that you share and that you modify together. The communication space is a space where you talk to each other. It can be voice, it can be text, it can be other things that you exchange, but it's about exchanging information. And of course, oftentimes you will exchange information about the thing you're designing in common. And vice versa, designing things in common requires to communicate. And then the coordination is sort of the higher level things of who does what, the division of labor, if I go back to activity theory. And in coordination space, of course you use communication. You send email to say, well, you're doing this, I'm doing that, or you use Doodle to create, to figure out a meeting time and things like this. You also coordinate the production of things. But these three activities are really different. The problem is that for a tool to be successful, I think they should be taken into account inside the tool and using, you know, email to coordinate or Doodle to coordinate, email to communicate, and then some shared editor for production will cause problems because you have to manage different tools and so it becomes complicated. So I think we're still missing a set of desktop tools that allow us to integrate these tasks more fluidly. Okay, the last section here. Oh, all of that? What is that? Oh, yeah. The last section was how do we implement these things? So distributed systems we know are hard to build. Plus, every time you build one of the systems, you have the issue that either you have to build a system where everybody is going to use the same system, which is often just impossible because I'm on the Mac, you're on the PC, and you're on Linux, so we're in different platforms. So not only it's hard to make a distributed system in the first place, but it is, if it's going to have any success, it's going to have to work in a heterogeneous environment. To some extent, the web solves part of this because everybody has a browser that, you know, understands more or less the same things. Although if you talk to web designers, they will tell you that it's still far from being true. So there are two main goals when you implement those systems. One is to make the system work to support the tasks that you want to support, whether it's messaging, whether it's sharing documents. And that's what I would put under collaboration transparency. It's really solving the basic problems that you need to get solved to make the system work. Oftentimes, it's going to be adding collaboration to an existing non-collaborative tool, which makes things harder than if it's designed from the beginning. And so, very often, what it will do is say, well, I don't want to make Word collaborative. What I'm going to do is allow you to share a Word window, but, you know, I'm just shipping the pixels around, and then I will do a turn-taking management so that one of us can drive Word at some point, so you get to type or I get to type, but we don't get to type together. So this is an approach where you make the collaboration fairly transparent, but you don't really support all the awareness. I don't know what the other is doing. You don't support the fine-grained collaboration. I have to give you the pen to write, if we use that metaphor. So you need to manage the term taking. So the second aspect is when you try to make really collaboration-aware systems, systems that manage synchronization and concurrency, so we can actually work together simultaneously as if we were on the same table or on the same board. And supporting the awareness of what the others are doing. So if you look in the literature, there is a whole vocabulary that is used for specifically for groupware systems. The users are participants in the sessions. They may be invited. You support turn-taking or open floor for deciding who's in control. You need telepointers to see what the others are doing. It can be synchronous, asynchronous. You distinguish between response time, which is how quick the system reacts to my action on my machine. A notification is how much time it takes for my action to be seen on your machines, etc. So I'm not going to go into all the details. Why don't I have this full screen? So these systems create really specific needs that are not covered by a lot of the tools that we use today, to create distributed systems. The goal in particular, compared to traditional distributed systems and distributed databases, is to not be transparent. I want to know who's accessing the database, what part they're accessing, what are they doing. So we've seen some of the problems that you have to deal with. View congruence. It's one thing to share the document, it's another to share the view. Sometimes you want one, not the other, sometimes you want both. All the issue of awareness oftentimes require that you know very precisely what the users are doing, if you want to do eye contact or gaze awareness in systems. Well, let's skip feed through. Latecomers is how do you require everybody to be in the session at the beginning and then until the end? Well, that works if you're doing some kind of a formal meeting. But in real life, people come in, go away, and so you need to accommodate latecomers in your system. So, oops, this is weird. So essentially, you have three ways of doing this. The easy way, but that doesn't work well, is the centralized way. So you put a server somewhere, everybody is a client. Everything that you do is sent to the server that processes it and sends the output to everyone. Well, as soon as you are geographically distributed, this doesn't work. So the other extreme is replicated, where everybody is running one copy and they talk to each other to synchronize their state. And that can work, but it's really hard. So usually what you find is hybrid systems where one part is replicated and one part is centralized. and you replicate the parts that will require a quick response, and you centralize the things that can live with 1 second, 2 seconds, 5 seconds feedback. So, you know, if you're doing a real-time editor, how real-time does it have to be real-time? What I want is that when I type, I want things to show up immediately. If the others see it 1 second or 2 seconds later, it's no big deal. Even if we are in video conferencing and we can talk and to each other, you know, for this task, it's acceptable to have these delays. In other tasks, it may not be. If you do a 3D manipulation task, you want, or if you're playing music, you want much faster coordination, synchronization. So the tools that have been developed to do this type of systems go from screen sharing to Windows systems to toolkits specifically designed for supporting distributed systems. So screen sharing, you know that probably already. You know VNC? Yes? So VNC is a system you can run on every computer, on any computer. It takes a part of your screen and sends those pixels to a client. So this works well for lightweight collaboration. But if I want to do really things like shared editing, so what happens with things like shared editing is that I want my feedback to arrive immediately, but it doesn't matter if you get it a little bit later. The problem is that you are doing the same thing at the same time. You are also editing. You want your feedback to occur immediately, and I will get it a couple of seconds later. Now, since we're not going through a central server that could sequentialize everything and say, well, I'll take my input first, then yours, then mine again, etc., we may both, for within this second of delay, we may both be editing the same part of the text. And if you're not careful, I may end up with one text on my screen and you end up with another text because things will be done in different orders. So this is a family of algorithms that are well known in distributed systems called the consistency of replicated data. And what is done usually if you do this with a database is you say, oh, I don't want concurrent access, so I'm going to use a lock. So the first one gets there, puts the lock, does what it wants. When it's done, removes the lock, and the others can then do what they have to do. Now, if we did this for a text editor, it would mean that I would have to first lock the paragraph I'm working on. It means you can't edit it. Then when I'm done, I have to remember to unlock it. And then we can. So people have tried this, and it's pretty terrible. So we want something that works without all this locking. So typically, the way it works is it assumes that there won't be a conflict. And if there is a conflict, it will make sure that it's resolved in the same way in all the sites. And if you have proper awareness tools, people will avoid conflicts. It's like when two people are next to a board, they don't bump into each other. So if I know where you are editing, I will probably stay away from it. So statistically, the chances of conflicts are lower if you have awareness. And they are certainly lower than if you have, they're certainly much higher if nobody knows what the others are doing, like in a distributed database. So here's an example of the algorithm we designed for the group design tool that I talked about. So essentially, when you do something, it's executed locally immediately, and it is sent to the other who execute it when they can. When I receive something that comes from elsewhere, all the events are timestamped. So I know if it is late. So what I do is locally, I undo everything until that time, I execute the thing that arrived late, and I re-execute the things I did since then. Now, all this undo, redo happens without the user seeing it. So it's done in a fraction of a second. Now, there still may be conflicts because you may have destroyed an object that I edited later. Except when I edited it, I didn't know it was destroyed. So what we did is we made sure that two operations were either commuting, so it didn't matter which order they arrived in, or the first one would be, the effect of the first one would be completely hidden by the effect of the second one. So I'll take an example here of two conflicts. The second user here changes the color of the shape to orange. And the first user had changed it to a rectangle. And it happened in the order where it was first A and B. I don't understand. If even A is a change of shape, I should have a rectangle up there. Oh, no, sorry. Okay. Start over. I have a rectangle. I'm sorry. I am pretty tired. So, I have a rectangle. That's masking. I've gone the wrong way. The computer is not being nice to me. Okay, I start with a rectangle. Then I receive a change of shape, event A, that turns it into an ellipse. And then, event B, this ellipse is turned into, colored orange. So I end up with an orange ellipse. Now, if those two events arrive in the opposite order at the other side, it means that first rectangle will turn orange, and then the orange rectangle will turn into an orange ellipse. So the end result is the same when all events have been processed. The intermediate step is different, but the thing converges. And so when operations commute, which means they act on independent parts of the object, like the shape versus color, the order doesn't matter. The other case is when the operations conflict. So here, A turns the object blue, and then B turns it orange. But at the other side, these are received in the opposite order. So here I have a problem, because after all events have been processed by everyone, one has an orange rectangle and the other one is a blue one. Well, remember that all the events are timestamped. So when the second one receives A, it knows that it happened before B. And so, because A happened before B and was masked by B, that means B was changing the same attribute as A in that case, I should ignore A at the second site. And so if you design your basic operations, not necessarily what the user can do, which is higher level, but if your basic operations always commute or mask each other, and you do this timestamping so you know the strict order of things, you can always make sure that everybody will end up having the same document, even if they see things that are different in the middle. So there are many variants of this type of algorithms. There are other approaches, but they all tend to do the same thing. Be optimistic. Assume things will go well. Detect if they go wrong, and make sure we fix it all in the same way. And so the fact that all these algorithms exist gives no excuse to the Microsofts and others to not have that in their systems, because it's not a technical difficulty at this point. So it's 5 o'clock, so I'll go very quickly over this. This was a toolkit that was built at the University of Calgary. to support a number of groupware widgets and aspects of building groupware applications. So I will skip the architecture, just to say that it is the hybrid architecture. There's one central process, the registrar, but most things are in fact replicated. Each user has a session manager and then various shared tools called conferences. And so in GroupKit, they created a number of awareness widgets to be able to say who is there, what are they doing, what are they seeing, and things like this. So I'll show a few of them. So telepointers, if you're editing text, you see where the others are. So each user is given a color, so that works only for small groups. And as you see in the front window, the red and the blue caret tell me where the other users are in the document. So that's a text telepointer. You can also have a real cursor telepointer, as we've seen, I think, before. Multi-scroll bars, we saw that with Sassy, so they implemented it in this toolkit. So every user here has a bar next to normal scroll bar that tells you what part of the document they're seeing. A radar view, I can have a zoomed out version view of the document to see the overview of the document, and with this little square here, the outline shows me what a particular user is seeing. So we had seen that in group design, but here it's implemented as a widget in the toolkit, so you just can add it to any application fairly easily. Fisheye views, so in their text editor, they have a system that automatically increases the detail around the places where I am editing and the places where others are editing, and the rest of the text, as you can see, gets reduced. So it allows me to see the detail of what everybody is doing without having to use scrolling too much, because the zoomed out part will save space. And they created a number of applications for brainstorming and chatting, for drawing, painting, or graph editing, as we see here, for editing files, text files, various text editors, and of course a few games to prove their point. And so that was in fact at the time the only really usable toolkit that you have, that you had to create groupware applications. And to me it's sad to see that, you know, we've done that in the lab. When was GroupKit? It says here, but it was in the late 90s, mid-90s, so it's been a good 15 years. And it's still not out there for other people to build these applications in modern toolkits like, I don't know, Qt or Swing or you name it. So to conclude, I'm not sure what to say quickly. Jonathan Gruden has worked a lot in CCW from more the social perspective and has identified a number of problems in the deployment of CCW, because it's an area, you know, it started in the 60s with Engelbart, and we still don't have these tools really. I mean, Skype is solving one little piece and Facebook another little piece and this or that particular application a little piece, but groupware is still not part of the basic software we use. So he identified these 8 problems. I'm not going to go through them. And he has a very well-known paper about this. And so just to conclude, since we are short of time, I said that as with HCI, but maybe even more than HCI, the problems are both technical and human, and the solutions are both technical and human. On the human side, you need to understand group work and group activity, including group play and group social networking and things like this. But it is also true that deploying these systems is harder than deploying simple interactive systems. And so the solution also is technology is not solving everything. The solutions have to include the human factor and the way we are used to communicate. It stuns me. I am absolutely surprised that people do not realize that by going onto Facebook, they give away all the rights on all the information they put onto Facebook, which is, to me, unacceptable. This is why I'm not on Facebook, in fact, or any social network for that matter. But this is not an acceptable human solution. People should have the right on the information they put into a system. So I hope I've given you a little bit of a sense of this rich area. If you have any questions, I'll be happy to answer.